Once I was 90 plus, we had him on a tape at a lunch which we had called him for at the Manitoba Club.
This is Cy Leach.
Yes. And he told us how when he was a small boy in short pants, they had ridden on the train, which was, I think, then the Great Northern train that went on the Northern Line, and there were many elevator owners on the train, and they would take turns in stopping every 7 or 8, 10 miles, and two or three would get off, and they would build the elevators in that town, and then they would go on, and then a different three would get off in the next town, and that's how the whole layout of those Western elevators happened. And at the end of it all, they all formed a single company called the Northwest Line Elevator Company to handle the insurance, so that they didn't have to pay insurance companies huge sums of money. And that company is still in existence, and Bill Parrish is its chairman now, I think. And but I mean, there were a lot of real characters there. Alec Purvis had come over from England, I think, about 1919, and came out here and formed a grain company and got into the business buying little lots and grew and developed into a big company and became very successful. He then had the franchise for the Volkswagen motor car from Thunder Bay to Vancouver, which was an interesting business venture, but he sold it over time. But we knew Alec very well. He was a tough old Scotsman, but a wonderful, wonderful character. And his boys, Bob and Ian and David. But that business has gone. But they were real stalwarts of characters, and they established the bar of trading integrity. And you step out off that bar, you're not going to do any more business. You may as well quit the next morning and go and join another industry, because word of mouth alone that you had welched on a deal, you'd be dead. You couldn't walk on the trading floor the next morning. And these guys are the ones who established that kind of level of thinking. And Ken Powell was another big company in those days. So there was a big exporting company then called Smith Vincent. Clancy Smith and Arthur Vincent ran that company. And Smith Vincent Grain was a very big exporter of wheat all through the 30s to England. And they've still got family around here. And guys like Clancy and Art.
What happened to their company if it was big in the 30s?
Well, the wheat board took over wheat, and they were the kind of casualties of the wheat board takeover. But I can remember very well working with Clancy Smith on various things. I remember one night we were having the annual general meeting of our little investment club at the Carlton Club, and we got a little bit too rambunctious and had a bit too much fun, and a very senior member of the club came in late. Well, I was the registering member for this investment club, so the blame landed on me, and I get called up before the discipline committee of the Carlton Club for conduct and becoming a member. Two very well-known senior doctors in town were in that investment club. Their wives were having a steam bath, and when this guy walked into the steam bath. But anyway, so I'd get a hold over the mess, and the chairman is about to rap me with a huge fine, and wanted to suspend me from the club and all kinds of that. You know, we'd expected a wrist slap and whatever. And he was getting all shirty about this. Suddenly, Clancy Smith looked across at Art Vincent and said, "Yes, Arthur," he said, "my memory is failing me today. trying to remember. Who was the chairman of the board? Remember that? Was it VJ Day or VE Day? Do you remember that lovely party? That lovely lady jumped out naked from the cake on the table. And the chairman, who was trying to pin this thing on me, blushed like crazy and said, "Well, that's different." And so on. And I said, "Oh, I don't know, Tom." He said, "It's sauce for the goose, it's sauce for the gander." But like this. So like this. So the guy thumped the table and said, "Get out of here, Dawson. Don't be so stupid next time." And that was the end of the meeting. And now I have no idea what the heck they got on the chairman, but they sure pulled it at the right time. But I mean, so off I went to Argentina, and we were fishing in the southern part of the Andes Mountains, and we stayed at a tiny little B&B, and they were having Saturday night dinner, and this guy turned around and said, "Oh, Winnipeg, eh? What brings you from Winnipeg?" And so we were touring and stuff. And he said, "Did you ever know a guy in Winnipeg called Clancy Smith?" And I said, "How on earth do you know Clancy Smith? I knew him. I was standing beside him when he died of a heart attack on the trading floor of Winnipeg's pit." And he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that," he said. I said, "How did you know him?" He said, "Well, on day two of the war, World War II, my father, they were Anglo-Argentines, going back grandparents, sent me to England, told me to join up and fight." And there were hundreds of Argentines who went to England and formed their own squadron in the RAF, like the Free Polish Squadron and so on. And he said, "No sooner had I been in England with the RAF than they shipped me to a place called McGregor, Manitoba, to learn how to fly a Spitfire." And every weekend, this guy Clancy Smith and a fellow called Arthur Vincent would send cars out to McGregor and bring us in for the weekend to their lovely homes in Winnipeg and throw the most wonderful parties with the most gorgeous girls you've ever seen. And he was laughing about how he knew Clancy Smith from World War II. And that was at the house on Nanton. But these guys were characters, very colourful.
There was a Mr. Schwartz?
Yes, Charlie Schwartz, from Northern Sales. Another really real character, came back with one of those early waves of Jewish migration, I think as early as the 1880s and 1890s, those families came in, and they'd been in farming in southern Manitoba and so on, and their company had grown. Northern Sales was the name of the company. Charlie was a great character, and we had a character in our Geneva office who was a Czech immigrant. He couldn't go back into Russia. He was a student leader during the student riots in 1956. But he became a very senior executive and ran a lot of our business in Europe. Wonderful guy called Michael Sladek. And Michael had a wonderful art collection. And in it were two of a set of five of a particular artist. And he called me one day and said, Dick, you're an old chap. He said, "What are you doing?" Said, "You have a fellow there in Winnipeg," he said. "My name is Charlie Schwartz." I said, "Yes, I know him." And he said, "You know him?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Well, how well do you know him?" And he came back and said, "There's this wonderful Czech trading thing." And he said, "Well, he's got three of a set of five, of which I've got two. Now, one of us ought to have the five. They really ought to be together. Now, see if you think he might be either interested in selling me his or perhaps buying mine." So I was on the trading floor, and Charlie was on the trading floor. I went over, "Charlie, I've got a minute. I need to talk to you." And so Charlie said, "Oh," he said, and they chatted to him, "Oh, well, that's Sue Slater." He said, "Well, tell him I'm not really interested in selling mine. What does he want for his?" You see, so I was the go-between on this thing. And these were, you know, $100,000 each, these things. I mean, these were big time stuff. So, you know, these were the kind of characters that you were dealing with, wonderful guys, and Charlie Schwartz was one of them. Very right-wing guy, didn't have very much time for anything the other side. But really remarkable when you think that the size and strength of somebody like Cargill, and these guys are your main competitors, and very effective at it. I mean, you know, your size didn't get you anywhere when it came to that kind of customer relations. We always thought it was interesting. How on earth did Charlie Schwartz keep on doing the business of Syria? You know, and they did, by performance and record and tradition and whatever. So they were very, very good at their business, and they had some very good staff too. And
are any of
no Charlie's staff son around? Chris has just died. Mm-hmm. Chris ended up being much bigger in real estate and Arizona desert and stuff. I think he was quite heavily involved in some American investments, and he never really, really took over the grain business after Charlie left. It gradually declined. But there were two or three characters in that. Jimmy Dunn was one of his guys, and I traded a lot with Jimmy Dunn, and he was always fun. And his number two man was a fellow called Maxi Nasgard, and I mean, there was a real character if ever there was one. I mean, when I first came here, and I'd been here about a week or two, Maxie invited me to his family, to join his family for dinner, and I'll never forget meeting his mother and his wife. Unbelievable people. Unbelievable. Concentration camp survivors. And wow. It was a privilege to have known them, you know.
Off tape, you had mentioned something about Mr. Rowan's reputation preceding him around the world. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, I think there were certain markets where, I mean, he was just very dominant. And he had a big background in transportation and down in Montreal. And so the whole orchestration of the right ships at the right place and the right grain in the right port at the right time was very much his ball game. And he was good at it and had been all through the war. I think he was involved in sort of organizing, you know, after the war, he was involved in getting things running back after the war and getting those transportation systems up and running. And so when the great big increase hit in the 60s. I mean, that was almost Frank's playground. I mean, he was so good at that. And smooth performance on contracts, you know, is of tremendous importance because there's millers at the other end waiting for the grain and so on. And I think Frank sort of had a high level of understanding of all of that and all its repercussions. And so, you know, played an invaluable role. And in those days, the wheat board itself actually sold all its grain to the grain companies, and we did all the logistical sorting out. Later on, the wheat board took it over themselves. And I'd have to say it didn't work as well after that. I mean, they still had total control of all the wheat sold, but they would sell it to Cargill at Thunder Bay, and we would take it down to Baie-Comeau, and if the ships were late because the grain wasn't there, it was our fault, not the wheat board's. And we paid the demurrage on the ship waiting.
So, why do you think that change was made?
I don't quite know. I think there was I think it was a sad thing. I think it's one of the. I think it was a sort of a feeling that here's another area of activity that we, the farmer, can take over, and that we don't need someone else to do it for us. And in the process of doing that, they underestimated the risks that were being taken over. When you hand over those kind of jobs to another system to handle, with it goes the risk. And when they did it for themselves, they suddenly found themselves paying the demurrage for the ships that were waiting. And they didn't like that. S- It's an old story, that one, and it happens in many businesses. There comes a point when you are better off to pay the money to the professional who knows what they're doing and let them get on with it, rather than trying to do it yourself. And if you try to do it all yourself, you're not going to be an expert at everything. And you meet that in at home, you meet it in painting, you meet it here, you meet it everywhere. Sometimes pay the pro at his game, and so long as you get good service, pay him his price.
We left off your career as the vice president of Cargill operations in Winnipeg.
Right.
And that was where you stayed until your retirement?
Yep.
And but near the end of that time, you were more involved with corporate policy.
I wasn't trading anymore, and I wasn't selling grain anymore. I was much more involved with, you know, issues of international grain policy, working with NAFTA and working with the WTO, what became the WTO, and trying to get tariffs changed, you know, and subsidies changed, and get international agreements on stuff. You know, we've always had huge rows over shipments to the States. You know, there's a large body in the States that doesn't like Canadian system because they don't understand it, and B, they think the Wheat Board is a totally subsidized government sales agency, which is not quite true. There are some subsidies in there, and the initial price is itself a subsidy if it ever comes into play. But I think in 60 years, the initial price has only failed, you know, with the final price being below it about 3 times in history. So it really is a false argument. But, you know, you answer them with poetry. You know, come on, Canada, that they'll say in the USA, those big subsidies you should not pay. Oh, we do it, it's true, but don't do as we do, just do as we say.
We're finding that there are several poets in the grain industry. So,
we do it with the supply control group. There's a lot of industries in Canada that are managed by tight supply, where production is limited, quotas are limited, and so on, like milk and eggs and so on. And with those, the Americans really hate that stuff, so... You know, half the time their animosity towards Canadian agriculture is towards the supply managed area, and we sort of retaliate with them on those. But sort of Mary Dairy, quite contrary. How well does your barnyard grow? With those quotas so long and tariffs so strong and those subsidies all in a row, that sort of thing.
So if you look at, it would seem to me to be somewhat of a shift from the operational side then into the more
policy. Areas, yeah.
What surprised you about that, or what did you find disappointing, fascinating?
No, it was very fascinating, and obviously very, we would have never changed the crow if it hadn't been for the international developments at the World Trade Organization. There was an international agreement that everybody was having a race to see who could give away the most money in grain subsidies. And there was. I mean, the common market was, agriculture in the common market was 5% of the GNP, employed 10% of the people, and spent 60% of the entire budget of the common market. Now you've got literally millions of very small farms, very inefficient. But a social culture around those small farms in France and Italy and England and whatever, of tremendous importance. So they couldn't let agriculture just sink. They had to subsidize them to keep them there. It paid them to maintain the tourist industry. And their grain subsidies were almost a tourist subsidy more than they were agriculture. Well, you try and tell that to Washington, D.C. about Iowa and Ohio, you know. So they retaliated with huge farmer subsidies in the States. And then everybody agreed that this game of the subsidy wars of the 80s was wild and crazy. And it got up to huge sums. you know, like $100 a ton item was subsidized $50 a ton. And so there was a genuine agreement to try and cut down by sort of 20% over a number of years. So you had to look at that time, Canada in total agriculture was subsidizing about $4 billion. So we had to find about $800,000, $800 million to play, to fulfill our part of the agreement, which was almost exactly the same as the cost of the Crow's Nest Pass Waitway. So in how you did it and which industry you did it to, or a little bit to every industry, it didn't really matter. The law said you reduce your total agricultural subsidies by 20%. Well, Canada was left with a decision of two things. You either cut back the subsidies in supply management in Ontario and Quebec, or the Western Grain Farmers Crow's Nest Pass Waitway. Guess which one got cut? I mean, there was no way that the politicians were going to cut the Quebec and Ontario subsidies. And plus the fact the Crow's Nest Pass freight rate was such a bad and damaging thing anyway. It had led to monocultural wheat practices, monocultural cereal grains, to the detriment of the livestock industry, all the manufacturing industries, the milling biscuit companies that used to be in Winnipeg, Peak and Freen, Nabisco was here, everybody was here making biscuits, Christie's biscuits, and so on. They all died and went away because of the wheat board control system. And so the Crow's Nest Pass freight rate was a good thing to get rid of. Doc Rennie in Saskatoon reckoned that the monoculturing of cereal grain farming in Western Canada had reduced the fertility of Western soils by 50% since World War II. And if it continued, we'd have a dust bowl again. So we needed to get rid of that Crow thing. So it wasn't just the Quebec-Ontario thing. It was also sensible economics that said get rid of that Crow's Nest Pass rate. Since it happened, you've had a revival of the livestock industry. Lots of acres that should have never been in wheat have gone back to alfalfa and clover and pasture land that they should have been in. They were only in wheat because of the subsidy. So it was a good thing to get rid of.
I'm going to ask,
but that kind of stuff was, those are the end results of policies. So, you know, you got into the business of what is causing this thing and what do we do about it? Well, you go to an international conference and try and get this changed. So
in that position then, and looking at, you know, sort of Cargill's position in it that you were taking forward, could you identify a major success and a major disappointment in the negotiations, or is it just sort of moving towards eventual change?
I can recall very well changing hats and ending up in American conferences when their wheat board was being, you know, soundly attacked by speaker after speaker. And I was with Esmond Jarvis, who was then the chief commissioner, one of them. And it was difficult for Es because you can't get up and... when you go on the defensive in a public platform, and I was embarrassed for him about that, so I got up and gave a great big speech in favour of the wheat board. And he where did that come from? But thank you. You did it because you were a Canadian in a hostile environment, and some guy's taking a smack at one of your guys. You know, the fact that I didn't agree with him on the wheat board was irrelevant. You know, and because you knew him so well and stuff, you know. And when you go down there, they were fighting for things in the negotiating table that they wanted, and so were we. And we wanted access for our milling wheat to go down to the States and stuff. And they wanted to block it because they'd got farmers there that didn't like to see Canadian wheat coming down there. The milling association got up and spoke on our behalf. They wanted the wheat because it was better than theirs. That's why they wanted it. And the system that graded it was better. And they knew that every time they bought something, what it was that they were going to get. Whereas when they bought it from Aberdeen or Crookston, they didn't know what they were going to get. It was called Two Northern Spring Wheat from the United States, but it wandered all over the place. So, you know, you got into the thick of these arguments, and I think that and some of the success that I think that would be, you might not believe it, but I think was explaining how our system works. They have a support system for wheat when it's grown. They have an initial price. They have a, you know, a subsidy payment and a deficiency payment. It's not an initial price, but they have a whole structure of support programs in their system. They don't like ours, and so they criticize it, you know. So that joke about, you know, don't do as we do as we say is so true. I mean, there they are, subsidizing like crazy, and criticizing us for subsidizing. Hmm. Pot calls the kettle black. Now, I don't know. We can't look back and say we have had success there. But just keeping the business running and keeping the dialogues open and keeping the relationships open, rather than going into a beggar thy neighbor fight, is a success. And that takes a lot of nurturing. And occasionally it flares up into pretty ugly stuff. Then it tends to subside a little and so on. And that happens between Canada and the United States, and then that happens with Brussels in the common market. The sad thing now is that the common market has now taken in so many new members that are expensive, that it's draining the purse of the common market, or the common market, as they take in Greece and Italy and whatever, not Italy, and Turkey and so on, is almost compelled to find a way to reduce these expenses. So the common market is making overtures about, we agree we should be lowering subsidies. Well, they haven't said that in 50 years. And as they said that, we were all so good, at last we can get to the negotiating table. And the Americans left the table.
Because they weren't willing to look at Long subsidies.
Government and Bush and whatever, and were, you know, they off went off on a tangent on their own, right at the moment when, for 40 years since World War II, they had been the greatest champion of multilateral trade, and that the bilateral trade, I make a special rule with you, but I won't make that deal with you. The bilateral trade was negative for world growth, and multilateral trade, you treat everybody the same, was the way to go. And they had been the great defender of that since World War II. And when the day came to make it happen, they weren't there. Mm-hmm. And that was such a tragedy. Mm-hmm. That is something we might hope might get fixed now. And people like the Wheat Board and stuff must be watching that with a very close eye. We've done a lot of business with Cuba. There's now open talk that Obama is about to send a trade delegation to Cuba. What will happen is that he'll invite the boxing team or one of the baseball teams to come over. And I mean, do you remember when the American university's table tennis team went to China?
No.
And was very well received and so on. And big, big.
Was that Mr. Reagan's?
No, it was Nixon.
Nixon. Yeah, it's a little toe in the water.
Within 6 months of that table tennis team going over, he was in Peking himself. But I mean, it's just a little token thing that happens. It's about to happen in the United States and Cuba.
Is that a big market?
It's a good market. It's not a big market. It's a good market, though.
We've talked a lot, or you've talked a lot about things that have happened over your career. Have we missed any challenges that you faced that haven't already come out in your comments?
There's some fairly big recent ones, which will occupy the next 10 years. The Green Movement. Country of origin labeling in livestock and so on like that doesn't affect the wheat, doesn't affect Thunder Bay and wheat too much. But genetically engineered foods does. You know, crops that have been genetically engineered in one way or another, including wheat, will be very suspect, and we've got to handle that at an international level. The ability of science to play a major role in feeding the world in the next 20 years is huge. Much of it would be through this kind of genetic scientific skill. And the question is, how do you do it, and what do you do with the customer who says, I don't want my bread made out of genetically engineered wheat, so I won't buy it unless you guarantee me that you didn't use any genetically engineered wheat in it. Those issues are going to be rising like crazy, and are already. The companies that handle them, I don't think, have done a good job. And I would include my own old company, Cargill, in this. But the other engineers, you know, the people like Monsanto and so on, that are in the business of engineering disease-resistant crops, they've failed to properly educate their public that there is an enormous difference between genetic engineering and transgenic engineering. The transgenic movement is when you take an enzyme from an Arctic char, because it's the lowest living vertebrate in temperature and in iced water and so on, and you put it into a cow, or maybe put it into a wheat and make that wheat more frost resistant, you're moving some genetic material from one species to another in a manner that nature would not have ever done on her own. And therein lives Frankenstein. You know, the whole horrible dream of where does that go. If you simply take a piece of corn or a piece of wheat and genetically manipulate it so that it carries a higher level of iron or a higher level of lysine or a higher level of protein or a change in the amino acid structure to contain more beneficial things. The Egyptians genetically engineered wheat 3,000 years ago. This is not new. You constantly try to improve, but it's done within the species, and all we've done is find scientific ways to do it very rapidly rather than let it take place over hundreds of years. That kind of genetic engineering can do a great deal for world hunger, world food and whatever, and world health. I mean, if you could find a high iron rice, you'd save a lot of eye trouble in India, you'd make a, or China, it would be a major contribution to the health of the world. And all you'd do is genetically move stuff within the species. That's one kind of genetic engineering and shouldn't cause any Frankenstein thinking. The other one, I would want to see some very careful testing in my food of that game before it became loose. And yet, it should take place. That whole research is wonderful. If you could find a gene in a pig that can arrest MS or whatever, and there are games like this now being played, and if I had a daughter with it or something, I'd be saying to the scientists, go to it, guys, and hurry up. So that there is a place for the transgenic engineering game. I'm not sure it's in the food stream, but have you heard a sensible explanation from anybody in the industry like this? Not a word. So when you get ignorance, what moves in? Rumor.
And fear.
And fear. And boy, has it ever moved into the feed business on genetic engineering and organic food and all this stuff. So this issue is now to the point when, you know, I remember when I was in the industry, there was a story that Sainsbury's, one of the big grocery retailers in the UK, was planning that 5% of their business would be organic. Do you know what it is today? 35. So as we move on in agriculture, there'll be some gigantic issues like this on the deck.
Going back to the genetic engineering, and I'm certainly not well informed on this, but there's a separate issue, I think, of the patenting of grains. What kind of impact does that have on the industry, if any?
Yes, it does, because that usually applies to the production of genetically engineered crops that are resistant to certain weed killers, for instance, or fungicides or pesticides or herbicides, and you develop a crop that is resistant. But it's usually a hybrid, so it doesn't reproduce on its own. And so you have to go back to the seller to go back and get the seed next time. Or if it does reproduce on its own, they're not going to give you permission to use it again. So you've got some scientific patent blockages there that have got to be resolved. And the actual contribution of some of those inventions can be wonderful. There is all a downside. There always is. Nature has a tremendous ability to build blockages, and you develop a resistant strain of wheat that is resistant to a particular chemical. And within 5 years, you'll find growing in that same field a weed that has become resistant to that chemical. And the chemical was designed to kill the weeds, and now the weeds have developed an immunity, and you've got to find a new chemical. So round and round you go. So it's a very sophisticated and careful game.
It's not a game.
It's a very sophisticated exercise in science.
And ethics, really.
Right, and it's no different than it is now with us, and antibiotics, and human beings. And if you have too many of them, the day you need them, they may not work for you, because
and
you've had too many.
Pharmaceuticals too. I mean, it's all the same.
We're in that game. We're in that business of careful management of nature, and we better remember the words of Caesar: "Naturam virgo expulitate mori culit." You can drive out nature with a rod, but she'll recur and get you.
And what was that other quote from Socrates, was it?
Yeah, no man can understand, can be called, no man can claim to know the strategies of the world until he understands the business of wheat.
Do you remember where that comes from? So that we
in Socrates?
Yeah.
I don't know, no. What piece of his writing?
Yeah, I'll track it down.
Yeah, one of the great scholars in great languages at the university might be able to help you with it. I don't know where.
Yes, yes.
And if you really just sort of take the word wheat, I mean, look how in his own day it did. I mean, it determined where they went and where they invaded, and down the Nile Valley and Persia. And I mean, you can look at the strategic significance of wheat from the days when the pharaohs built 7 years of supplies to hold it in pyramids ready for their droughts. I mean, and then they developed their own drought-resistant wheat. Most of that drought-resistant wheat was done by selecting outliers and outrunners. My brother is a forester, and he's a genetic silviculturist. And he came over from England to the Queen Charlotte Islands in BC looking for salt-resistant varieties of white pine. And they would go out into a burn that had been burned about 10 years before, and they would look for the natural outrunners. And there in the whole hillside, you see like this, and one guy sticking up about 10 feet higher than the others. These were all 20 feet, and this guy was 30. Mm-hmm. And it was also usually early maturing, because it had fruit on top. And the others weren't in fruit yet. It's just like a young, immature kid who runs into puberty much earlier than normal. And the trees do the same thing. So they'd shoot the cones off the top with a gun, with a shotgun, collect the cones, stick them in the TV set overnight, turn the thing on with a sound off, burst the cone open, take the seed out from inside, stick an envelope, ship it back to England. They wanted a salt-resistant tree for Ireland and Wales and Scotland. And they got it that way. And they did it by selecting the outrunners. Well, you go back to the Nile Valley, that's exactly what the Egyptians did with their wheat. They'd look for an outrunner, an outlier, year after year after year. They'd get a drought and the whole crop fails, but that guy didn't fail. Wow, let's get that guy. And so they were selecting, they were playing genetics with wheat long, long ago. And all we've done is take that on to a new level of scientific expertise. And you can reproduce without having to wait season to season. You can get the plant to germinate by taking a cellular cut from the plant and getting it to germinate and grow about every third week. And the moment it's sprouted, you take another cut. So, I mean, you can get 15 crops a year, you know, in a lab. And that was before we went into some of the new developments in cellular research. But that's where I say, if they're accelerating what nature would do to herself, I'm pretty much okay and comfortable. When they step outside that and start doctoring stuff in a manner that nature would have never done on her own, I want some caution. I don't say don't do it. I just want to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those issues will be on the table for the future in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
The whole of the green movement will. I think the North American society and so much of Europe will be in a full-scale war on obesity long before they're in a full-scale war on hunger. The rest of the world will be on a war. The general opinion of the majority of informed agriculturalists would tell you that we really ought not to be too worried about the world starving. We've probably got the ability. We're 6 billion now, 7 billion to come, 8, 9, or 10. And the old graphs in 1950, the Treaty of Rome and stuff, in the 60s, that pointed to 10, 12 billion, have all flattened out. They're already flattening out. The age layer is rising quicker than they thought. And the actual, there's a lot of people saying that an end is in sight to population growth. It's no longer anywhere near as fast as it used to be. And it's certainly well below the level that it's unlikely that food will be the major thing or the problem of the future. Other things, like clean air and clean water, are likely to be much higher up the totem pole than a shortage of food. The issue of meat protein versus carbohydrates is an interesting one. On a global basis, if you look at diets, you know, we have about a half a billion tons of meat, about 500 million tons of meat. But the meat, and I've been at conferences where vegetarians get up and say, it's ridiculous that we go on putting 10 pounds of precious grain into an animal to make a pound of meat. And the whole room nods in agreement and says, yeah, that does sound crazy. And say, well, that's what they're doing, and they shouldn't do it, you know, and everybody should not eat meat. And so I got up and said, well, that's interesting. I said, the beef world operates at about 6 or 7 to 1, not 10 to 1. The conversion rate in pigs is 4 to 1. The conversion rate in poultry is 2 to 1. And the conversion rate in fish is nearly 1 to 1. So of all the meats, the average is about 3 or 4 to 1, not 10 to 1. But when you make that meat, the wheat that you put in and the grain that you put in had about 12 or 13% protein in it. When you get it back, it's got 35 or 36 or 38% protein in it. Plus a heck of a lot of iron and other things that the wheat didn't have. So on a nutritional basis, it's an excellent conversion, because this guy is walking around a mountainside that you couldn't even grow wheat on if you wanted to. So you're bringing into production land areas to provide precious human food. And if you were to take meat out of the global equation of nutrition, you'd have mass starvation in 2 seasons. And they said, wow, is that right? You know. And then they sort of turn on the speaker from vegetarian land, you know, that vegetarian now. There are some things you can do as a vegetarian to strengthen their own argument. Like, instead of getting your protein from cattle, get it from peas and lentils, and so they're, which are quite high. They're 25 or 28% protein. They're not 12. So there are some things you can do to improve the human condition. But frankly, the consumption of some acreage in pastures and clovers and alfalfas for livestock production is a very sensible, balanced economic thing to do that helps the soil long range. And there's lots and lots of good reasons why a vegetarian type farming system has got some real serious problems with it. Now, those issues are going to arise more strongly as the critical point of feeding the world arrives over the next 10, 20, 30 years. Most people in the grains end of the industry are optimistic that we will beat the problems that will get thrown at us in feeding the world. That won't be number one on the political agenda, compared with rotten water and...
The last part of your career then was after you, I put in quotation marks, retired. Can you tell us a little bit about when that started and what you got busy with to keep you from being bored in retirement?
When I sort of started the sustainability debate and stuff?
Well,
the
no, echo... when you moved from... Cargill,
yes.
Into retirement.
Yes.
I know nothing about your...
Yeah. Well, I had always been interested in the issues of sustainable development. And I had watched the movement and been a part of it. I was a member of the Partnership for Sustainable Development in the early 70s here. And I sat with Alan Scarth in a little wooden hut out at Fort White when there was nothing there. And... So I'd always been interested in that issue of sustainable development. And it was interesting because while that was happening, the environmental movement was rising. And the environmentalists hate the sustainable development guys. Because sustainability requires a balanced approach to three issues: economic, social, and environmental. If you want to put a bridge across the river of Assiniboine, you might kill a few fish or something, so you've got an environmental issue to look at. You've got an economic interest because you save 76,000 cars a day, 10 miles each. That means carbon emissions of Y number. And then you've got a social issue of the time saved and the convenience of all the people who travel there. So those three issues come together. You say, go ahead and build the bridge. The three fish we're going to kill are not on the endangered list. And so on. We don't even eat them in the river. So there are low-level risk things. So you go ahead and you build the bridge. The environmentalists don't like that because sustainable development out-argues the purely environmental approach. And the environmentalists regard the sustainable development guys as a threat because they are no longer number one. The environmentalists want to be number one. And so you don't get... You want to look at the life change in that time. I mean, 25 years ago, he was a tree hugger. Today, he's a very rational scientist screaming for compromise and balance.
And you're referring to a book?
David Suzuki.
Suzuki's book.
Yeah.
Sacred Balance.
Mm-hmm. And his whole campaign today as a scientist is for rationality and coming together and creating some balance in the thinking. So I had been in, I loved it, even when I was with Cargill, and we you could smell it coming and hitting the business. And the sustainability of the Western soils required a return to some livestock farming. The soils of southern Saskatchewan should have never been ploughed for wheat. So in terms of sustainable development, there were some practices going on that had been distorted by various government policies and the subsidy war and whatever. And so the sustainability issue hit me inside the business world long before I retired. and you could see the need. One of the needs that was not taken care of was what is we used to call it manure. Not anymore. It's now called nutrient management. And that's really what it is. You've got this precious substance that ought not to be a problem. It should be regarded as valuable if you learn to manage it properly. And we hadn't done that. And we used to burn our stubble. We used to do all kinds of crazy things. We used to chuck the pig manure all over the place. And it would go off into the river. I mean,
we're still doing that.
Yeah. And yet other countries have long ago figured it out and lined their lagoons and get no seepage. And, you know, we think that we're a big deal in pigs because we've gone from 3 million to 5 million. You know, there's 100 million pigs on the island of Taiwan. And Holland has got 25 million and we've got 3 or 4. I mean, you know, do we think we're a really big heavyweight in the pig business? And if they've got that in their crowded little country and it's all low-lying land, how do they manage the manure? We've got some things to learn, and we're terribly blind and slow to adopt and think we've got it right. And so I think those issues were fun, and I got into them more heavily after I got out of Cargill, and it was fun, still is. There's so much going on of significance, major structural changes in the world. You know, I think that the shift to Obama itself has got some potential to really bring a new period into place. Let's hope. And then we can get on with the business of trying to really fix some of the real sore points. You know, like starving Africa and starving Bangladesh. India is actually making strong strides The double issue of energy versus food is a new feature of tremendous importance. Throughout the whole of my career, the farmer had one place to go with his grain, for the most part, and that was world food. It was either going into either food or beer, one or the other, but it was human consumption. And today there's another guy knocking on his door saying, I want your grain. I want to make ethanol out of it. And I don't care if it's got high protein. On the contrary, I want low protein, but I want huge yield. And so you research wheat for a totally different objective, and the wheat that they will produce for ethanol will not make bread. So you'll take up acreages to make this ethanol, or corn for ethanol. That issue on the table will be big. In general, I think it's a healthy thing, because I think the farmer, in the whole of my 40-odd years, there were only about 2 or 3 short periods when the farmer was well paid. For the most part, they were poorly paid for their work. And I think now that there are 2 buyers wanting their crop, and 2 people saying what they should put on the acreage, it'll be a beneficial thing for farming. And I think we'll see stronger and better farming and more productivity coming out of the land. So I don't regard the ethanol thing as a threat so much as an opportunity. And there will also be a huge increase in alternative substitutes. Biodiesel with canola oil and soybean oil is actually much more economically sensible than ethanol. Ethanol is not a very economic sensible thing to do. It may be strategically sound politically to grow your own energy than go and buy it from somewhere else, and that's its main attraction. But it's not particularly sensible. Biodiesel is. We could really, really make a lot of biodiesel fuel out of canola oil and do it at an economic level. So that's a different issue again. And then that's before you get off into the wind powers and the solars and so on. I saw in the paper the other day that during the recent big windstorms in Europe, Spain was providing 40% of the national grid with electricity from wind. Now, you know, where are we? You know, I mean, we're nowhere near that. We're 1% or something. So there's some things we've got to look at that are exciting and could come. And then I think there's some new things. I mean, we've never been in the textile business, apart from a little bit of linen in flax. And Canada has never played a role in it. The flax we grow is not the flax that the Belgians grow to make linen with. It's not the same kind of flax. Europe and others are growing large crops of hemp. And hemp is a magnificent crop. If the value of an acre of wheat is a $350 crop, $350, I mean, 30, 35 bushels an acre at $10 a bushel, maybe $300 or $400 per acre. Hemp is about $800 or $900. And it makes 40 different products. And we don't make any cotton. We can't grow cotton. We're blocking it off because of marijuana. We're not developing in hemp like the Romanians and Poles are and so on, and doing wonderful things. And I've got gorgeous clothing in this house that come from hemp. And we really ought to be doing a lot more about that. What we need is the scientists to come and help us. Do you know how? We'd like you to put a purple enzyme into the leaf of the one that we grow and let the silly buggers who want to go to California grow their damn thing and get caught and go to jail. But if we could colour it and change the colour. Right now we plant 40 acres of trial stuff around, we get permission from the government and the police and the RCMP and whatever, we organise it all, and you walk out in the middle of the field and there in the middle there's a 10 acre piece of this other stuff. And the stuff we're growing has about 1% of the acid, the happy acid, that marijuana's got in the flower. We have about 1%. There'd be more of that acid in a cabbage today than there is in that flipping plant. And we can't get them to grow because every time we do it, somebody lets the ship down.
No.
And you get some silly bugger going and thinking, and it keeps happening. And the police are tired of it. So we can't get any approvals and this sort of thing. The only way to do it is scientifically change the plant. Now, if we could do that, we would really have a new crop in Western Canada with tremendous potential.
But we huge. Own that
company. Yeah.
You're darn right. I'll buy shares in it.
Well, we're coming near our second hour mark, and there's just a couple of things I'd like to finish off with. One. It just sort of ties up your whole career. So this is maybe a tough question for you because it asks you, when you think back on your career, what has brought you the most satisfaction or what are you most proud of? And maybe actually those are two questions.
I think if I was to look for a highlight of enjoyment and accomplishment, we used to think of a sale of 100,000 tons at a time as being big, you know. And then we went to 200, then 500, and then 1 million, and then 2 million, then 3 million, then 5 million. And the shift in the dimension of the obligation you were undertaking required you to load a ship every day. Yeah? You know, you'd have four ships a week coming in for, and they were 40,000 tonners, not 20. So you know you're going to move one heck of a lot of grain, and that period from 63 through there was a collapse in 67, 68, 69. It improved again later in the 70s, and then it didn't improve again. There was another period of improvement in the 90s, but the real jump in expectation and global exports was in the 60s, and getting the railroads and everything else to move that kind of volume and getting it to hit at the right time and then getting it to the ship and so on at the right time was exciting. It was fun, and you know, you've probably seen the Pattersons. Have you seen Andrew? And
I've talked to Robert Patterson. Andrew's on our list.
Okay.
But
well, I mean,
a youngster.
Yeah,
so
that's right. Yeah. Well, Grandpa used to talk to me in the grain exchange. Dalton, I know names. And Senator Patterson was then 97 or something. And he wanted to know why we'd had to take his ship out of line at Baikomo, you know, and we're going to delay him for 12 hours. He wanted to know, what the hell are you doing? And I said, well, the ship behind you has got some barley on it. We need it to get the ship that's on the dock out. When the ship's on the dock's out, you know, another time we'll get you in front of someone else. Sure enough, 2 months later, we're pulling him out of line up front, you know. But sometimes you had to do these things and break the normal rule was ships come and get unloaded in turn. And you tried to do that as much as you could. Sometimes it just doesn't work out that way. And he used to hit the roof, the old senator, oh boy.
And, now I imagine he was a character.
Oh yeah, he was. I mean, he was a great, fantastic character. And on their 75th anniversary, Don Patterson here, there were two sons, Donald and Robert, at Thunder Bay. And Don read out a letter from his dad to his dad in 1913, I think, back in Scotland, saying that I have arrived in a town called Fort William, Port Arthur, and I like it, and I think I could do well here. I may stay. Mm-hmm. He did okay. What a lovely letter. And those sorts of people, you know, and Robert himself was quite a character. And I knew Robert a bit. And,
Robert was a character?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was just a rookie, and I went down there to fix a problem of loading a ship or something, and I was very young. Anyway, I had no money. I lost my money. I lost my wallet. So I asked him to lend me $100, and he never let me forget it. He was always just kidding my boss, saying, God, you're sending this damn rookie. First thing I got to do is lend him $100. Haven't you got any money in Cargill? So we had some good times with Robert.
So those heydays, it must be another term than hey, were pretty exciting and gave you a lot to be proud of, getting everything to click together.
And orchestrating the shipping itself, you know, you'd try and plan it out on about a 30 to 40 day forward cycle, because a ship going down to the St. Lawrence would take 6 days. And where we were unloading at Baikomo, you would allow a maximum of 2 days to get it unloaded. So that's eight. And then 1 day up to Sept Îles or Contrecoeur to pick up iron ore, 9. 5 days back to Toledo, Ashtabula, Cleveland, Gary, Indiana, or wherever on the American Iron Belt with the iron ore would be another 4 days. And now you're on to 13. 3 days deadhead up to Lakehead, 17, and load in 2 days. So you could get a turn, you could run a season on a ship and get 10 trips, that's 200 days from May, well, from April right now, opening up, closing in December, you're going to be talking at 220 working days. So maybe you could get an 11th trip in, and that was the ambition with a ship, to try and get 11 trips, you know. Mm-hmm. And I used to get a lot of phone calls from Senator Patterson and Upper Lake Shipping and CSL and all these guys, what the hell are you doing? Because if you dropped them by 5 days, you were the guy who stopped them from getting that 11th trip. Mm-hmm. Well, that's 10% of a year's earning when you're doing 10 trips a year. Mm-hmm. So you got into the milieu there of a totally different industry. You know, we used to do a lot with Paul Martin and stuff. And you get into the middle of that and stuff. It's very interesting and exciting. And it's fun when you do it and it works and they're happy and you're happy and you have a little party to celebrate something good where, you know, they got down there and they came out in 12 hours, you know. They went in, hit the dock just as the guy was leaving. And the guy said, keep your engine running, you're coming in. And the guy says, what? I haven't got here yet, you know. And he'd sort of check into the hotel and said, don't bother to check in, you'll be leaving at midnight. What? And we would. We'd put him on the dock at 9 and we'd have him out of there by midnight. You know, he'd fully expected to stay for 2 days. Well, you do that 2 or 3 times out of those 10 trips, he's going to get 11. So that was fun. The ocean side was just as much fun. Especially when you get on the West Coast. And you'd come into Vancouver where ships often waited 3 weeks and that sort of thing. And, you know, and you'd be bound for Japan. And we'd charter the ships, and I remember the wheatboard guy, Dave Yeats, would come to me, and he'd say, you know, we're putting barley in and stuff, and I'd say, what for? And he'd say, for the SS Maru Maru coming in from Japan. And I'd say, she yesterday took a load of coal from Brisbane to Korea. She isn't going straight back to Tokyo. And you think she's going to be here on the 10th of June? She's not going to be here before the 30th. And he said, we've got her chartered for the month of June. And I said, okay, I'll bet you she's here on the last day. And don't put the grain in the elevator for her until then, you know. So he'd go and do some checking and come back and say, how did you know? And I said, you know. And our Tokyo office would watch the ship unloads. And they'd send a notice to our ship captains that we'd chartered, saying, please open up the engines, we'll buy the captain a new hat. Well, that's language, meaning for a little, get a new hat. But you wanted him to spend fuel and time and money to hurry up. Because there was a big storm in the Pacific, a whole bunch of ships got jammed up, and there's 200 ships going to hit Tokyo Harbor in 4 days. You better be in front of them. So open up the accelerator and get there, and we'll pay you. But you've got to know what's going on at sea, and you've got to know where these storms are, and you've got to know where your guy is. Because if you get behind on that, now when you make a charter, that you make a charter with the guy, the SS Maru Maru, yes, I'll come to Vancouver and I'll take a load of wheat to Japan for you. And I will proceed to Vancouver after unloading in Brisbane. They missed a word out. The word is direct. I will proceed directly to Vancouver. And I had to tell the Wheatboard guy, you know, you get into this game, buddy, you better watch your words. He didn't put direct in, so the captain has the right to go off to Korea and do a side trip. Somebody said, I need a quick run, can you do it for me? He said, sure. So he went off there, and instead of turning up in Vancouver on June the 1st, he turns up on June the 30th, and he squeezed in another little trip because of the absence of the word direct. So there's stuff in there that you've got to, you know, but all that stuff was fun. You asked me what were the joys and the fun, you know, was staying on top of stuff like that and getting it done well was rewarding, personally. You know, mm-hmm. You got a kick out of it. And you got to know all the overseas buyers, the Poles and the Russians, on a personal basis. And that was a joy. They were great guys, very ethical and fun to deal with. And some of them pretty, you know, I can remember sitting in Earl Green's basement while Yaroslav Geisler, the head of the Polish grains buying delegation, played Chopin all night, magnificently, up and down. And there was a stupid little guy there with him, who was a sort of a communist spy guy. and he was out there to sort of watch these old guys to see that they was serving the government. And Yaroslav dropped into the old Polish national anthem, you know, the old Krakow national anthem, and started to, it was bad enough to be playing Chopin, which was a bad word anyway, but to drop into the old national anthem and so on. And they told him to stop playing. Geisler just turned around. Yaroslav Geisler came from a family of bankers. The name Geisler was the Hans Lauer Geisler Bank in Poland. It's about like Rothschild in North America. So Yaroslav's playing away, and he looked at the guy that told him to stop. He said, oh, go away, you silly little man. And he was telling about what a lovely holiday he'd had. A lovely holiday in summer. He said, we went down to work camp number 26, and it was wonderful, very nice holiday, gorgeous place, he said. It was such fun for me to renew my childhood. I was born there, and it was his match. It was his castle. Yeah, and they turned it into a camp, you know, and the little guy was furious, you know. But you saw these things going on between them, and Geisler was funny, velvet tie, velvet lapels, spats, silver-topped cane, Homburg hat. He looked like something straight out of a 1920s picture, you know. But he had to be on the delegation because he was the only guy who could tour the world and get financing credit on his name.
Fascinating.
Fun people.
Yeah. We have a couple of general questions at the end. I don't know if we mentioned to you, but it did mention in the letter that you got that at some point we're hoping to open a center to feature the history of the international grain trade. That may never happen, but if it does, what do you think would be important to commemorate, have preserved for the public related to the international grain trade? What are the essentials?
The cleanliness and reliability of the product that Canada has sent out to the world for years. And it doesn't really matter whether it came from a co-op elevator or a wheat board or a Cargill. Those are internal Canadian issues of interest. But in the job being done of feeding the world, you know, that's what it's all about. And I would think that somewhere in there, a little feel of something. And today it makes me feel good to look out, happy to look out at the youth in this room, full of young, bright brains, energy, and enthusiasm. These are young patriots that love this country of Canada enough to continue to fight to make it strong. I see myself 41 years ago now, and it seems like just yesterday. My boss's wife, Mrs. McGregor, found me in a one-room apartment underneath the boiler in Vaughan Street, and I was paying $27 per month for the room. And she took me shopping to the Army and Navy store to buy a kettle, two plates, a knife, fork and spoon, some sheets and a pillowcase. She gave me all the rest herself out of her cottage. She was one among so many people that had been kind to me in this country, and that this industry has also been good to me, and it can be good for these youngsters here today. I have every reason to love this country with all the patriotic fervour that is sometimes never stronger than in the naturalised convert or immigrant. You may take it less for granted, more for granted than I do. Let me leave you with the words of an articulate Englishman who, perhaps more than any other, had the marvellous ability to marshal the language and send it off to do battle for him, either in the cause of peace or of war. I refer, of course, to the halfway point of the century, on the 1st of January 1950, when Mr. Winston Churchill addressed the people of Canada on the CBC from the Chateau Laurier Hotel in Ottawa, and he said these words: "I believe in the unconquerable assertion of the spirit of our combined identities and survival. Together we have surmounted all of the perils and endured all the agonies of the past. We shall provide against and prevail over all of the dangers and the problems of the future. We shall withhold no sacrifices, grudge no toil, seek no sordid gains, and fear no foes, and all will be well with us. For I believe that you have within us the life strength and the guiding light by which the tormented world around us may one day find here the harbour of safety after its own storm-beaten voyages. A marvellous future awaits you in Canada, for when I first came here after the Boer War, these mighty lands had only 5 million people. And now there are nearly 14. When my grandchildren come here, there may even be as many as 30 million. Upon the whole surface of this globe, there is no more spacious and splendid a domain in which to perform the activity and the genius of a free people, who with one hand clasped in an enduring friendship with the United States, extends the other across the ocean both to Britain and to France. You Canadians have a sacred mission to discharge in this world, and that you will be worthy of it, I have no doubt." Isn't that lovely?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get to when you get to, you know, feeding the world is a fun thing to do with your day. You know, doing it well is worth doing. And you look back on it and say, what did you do, you know, with your life? you know, if you fed the world and did a good job and didn't ship shitty grain around the place full of mouse turds, you know, you've done something worthwhile. And I think that that sort of tone is what it's about at the end of this. Why you get up in the morning and go to work at 6 instead of 8, you know. And if you don't have that stimulus, you're a 9-to-5er. Go and do something else.
Last two. Others to interview? You've mentioned some along the way, and I've noted them here. Are there others to interview that we should put on our list?
Who have you noted that he said?
Well, I'm not sure that all of them are alive, and we'll be talking about that after we turn off the tape. You mentioned Dave Yates. Is he still around?
I don't know. You know?
And was he in Vancouver?
Yes, he was with the Wheat Board.
Okay.
God damn it. I was over in London on my way back from Warsaw or Poland or somewhere. You know, I dropped into London, you know, see mum, see whatever, family and things. And I was in the hotel and the phone rang. And it was Sheila Yates, his wife. She said, I called the office to speak to David and they said that you'd been on the phone and you were in London. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, you bugger, why didn't you let us know? And so on. You know, I knew them very well when I was managing in Vancouver. And he was the manager out there. I knew them here too. And she said, we've been in London now for 2 years and we've been waiting to get onto the royal list for the garden party at Buckingham Palace. And guess what? We got an invite for the garden party in Buckingham Palace today. And David had to go to Brussels this morning. I need an escort. So I said, what's the dress? And she said, full dress, morning dress and stuff. So I said, I'll get up to Savile Row, I'll rent an outfit. Which, you know, and I said, I'm at the hotel, can you be here? And so we arranged the time. So and she's got the official invitation, which includes a gold thing that you put in the window of your car to get through the gates and various things. So off we go to the palace. And so we get up there. And you're supposed to go around the backing of Buckingham Palace Road and in the back of the bottom of the garden. And the guy charges up the mall straight at the main gates. You know, and so Sheila yells at him, he says, we go in gate 3. And he says, when I go to the palace, I go through the main gates, baby. He says, I don't use the back gates, we use the front gates. And we go at the front. The whole of the guard comes up, chops and stuff. You go in, he says, that's what comes out having a son, chief of the guard. He says, so we go in the main gates in this little red cab and up to the front. Well, the joy is that when you go in that way, you get to go through the whole of the palace. And we took an hour to wander around and look at everything in the palace. Then out onto the verandas at the back and then out to the garden party, which is huge. It's a huge garden. And if there are all the other 1,500 invites to the garden party, don't get ever to go into the palace, you see. So anyway, we wandered out there. And here I am with Dave Yates, Canadian Wheat Board. So obviously, guess who, you know, we run into the whole of the grain trade out there. It's the grain trade's day, you know, that's why they were all invited. Mm-hmm. And there's the Spillers Millers guys, and there's all the guys from Ranks Hovis Brown, and all the miller buyers and stuff that all know me and stuff, and they all, oh, I see. Poor old David, he gets caught up and look what his wife does the moment
he leaves.
And she's just a Cargill guy, you know. So I gate crashed. It was my best gate crash ever. I gate crashed the Queen's birthday party in the palace.
The advantage of connections.
Yeah, but I don't know what David's doing anymore. Let me think about some people here.
Okay.
You've Billy Parish would be one of the big ones.
Yes, I've.
Okay.
Yes, I've had a very entertaining interview with him. Yeah, but why don't you think about it? And I'll ask the last question.
You've just missed two or three. Earl Baxter from the Canadian Grains Commission. It's amazing how many, when you ask a question like that, I can think of about four names and they've all gone in the last, you know, 4 months.
I know, it's very sad. The last item is memorabilia. We've talked about your collection downstairs.
Yes.
And so are there any things that you think would be useful when that you have in your collection that might be
yes,
useful
what
to
are you
our
forming?
Project?
You're going to form a center
well,
at the university.
Well, actually, what we were hoping to do, like this is our big dream, was we would actually like to set up on the site of an elevator.
Okay.
So that you have the magnificence of the elevators
yes.
there. But not in an elevator. So currently we were looking at the UGGM
yep.
site beside Viterra now, but beside Sasspool 7.
Sorry for interrupting you, but at some point you may want to talk about from a Thunder Bay practical point, the shift of the big ships eliminated so many elevators that couldn't either take a big ship that big, and you couldn't turn above the basin at Patterson's.
In the turning basin.
Yeah. And even there was 3 feet in the front and 3 feet at the back. By the time they swiveled that ship, it was pretty dicey stuff.
Right, and I think I brought a map last time of that stretch.
Yeah, I think I may
stretch.
Have that.
Yes, I think I...
have I still got that?
Yeah.
But
it was rolled up.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Anyway,
I'd forgotten to mention what that big ship did to... It delegated... It relegated a number of elevators out of the main shipment movement, and they became specialists in rye, malting barley, and other small things that freed up the big guys to get on with the big business, and they made a perfectly good living, thanks very much. They didn't all go belly up, but they became specialists at little things
mm-hmm.
that got
bird
in the way
feed
of the
and
big...
specialty
everything.
Seeds.
Yeah, yeah. We used to ship rye down to Chicago and Walkerville and Shenley's and stuff, and the big guys didn't want to handle it. It just got in the way of their main job. And Patterson had a lot of ships that loaded about the docks, you know, the Ontadock, the Manitodoc, and all the DOCs, mm-hmm. Dominion of Canada. And they were all, they weren't big, they were about 20,000 tons. And they could easily get in there. So they had a good time. We used to ship all kinds of stuff down to the States, oats to Buffalo and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. The resiliency, I think, of the grain industry in spite of a lot of changes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So
I'll think of some more people if I
yeah.
can.
In the absence of having a center, which was what I was
yes.
mentioning, we definitely have our oral history collection, and we'll likely develop a website so that photographs, some people have donated little artifacts, anything that you think might be useful, helpful.
Okay.
So,
and I won't just throw all of my things away. You saw that bank of...
Yes.
I don't know how many there are, but there would be... about 20 speeches a year for 20 years. That is at least 400 speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was, I have to give one next week to the Canada Grains Council. Just so happens, it's their 40th anniversary. And I gave one to them on their 30th. And it was the new age of agriculture, strategic positioning for tomorrow. And that was the kind of speech. Those ones downstairs and these guys, that's 99, 2000, mm-hmm. 201, just to give you the flavor of what they're about. The integration of sustainability between industry and agriculture. Worldwide sustainability in the Upper Great Plains, a threat or an opportunity. Global protein markets and the bison, mm-hmm. where does he fit in? Worldwide trends in sustainable development, the opportunities for value-added industry in Western agriculture, the global village, a planetary reconstruction project, an idea whose time has come. That was to the University of Minnesota.
So these
are the tones of the
sure. it's really a reflection of your career, because they would have followed all along from...
I finished up being more concerned with where were we going, you know, in the long range, rather than in the next quarter. Yeah. And I sort of shifted into a more long-term investment approach.
And this is very important in terms of, as Nancy is saying, we hope, you know, our dream is the center. But, you know, a building is one thing, but having all the information in this new world is just as important. And that's what we have control over, is doing the oral history and connecting with people and to seeing what people have in terms of artifacts or thoughts or their thinking. We can build that, and if, you know, it's terrible, say we never got the building, we still have the history. Mm. So that's why we're moving forward.
Have you become aware that there was a big wrong, that we guessed wrong? I remember going down to a meeting of the Thunder Bay Harbor Commission and giving a speech. There was a well-known guy who was head of that commission. He was the harbor master of Thunder Bay. Chet somebody. Anyway, I'll look it up. And they were planning a fight to raise an argument to get money from the government of Ontario and whatever to do major renovations to the port and get ready for the future. And the idea was that the good times were going to continue and that we were going to go on growing a little more and more grain. As you know, shipments have dropped off. And the prices have switched to cattle and pigs and things. And wheat is nowhere near what it was.
Yeah, it goes west.
And even it is much less. We were shipping 30 million tons out of both out of Vancouver and Thunder Bay at one stage, and then we're down to, what, 18, 12?
I think someone had mentioned to me that Canada was shipping two-thirds of what it was at its sort of height, and Thunder Bay was shipping one-third of that.
Right. That's correct. The big demand is off the, you know, the Asian Rim. You know, the Asian Rim has got, mm-hmm. what, 2-3 billion out of the 6 around here, and nowhere near enough, whereas the Europeans within, you know, given much as 500 million people in the common market, can pretty well raise enough food for themselves. Mm-hmm. So there are big differences.
So when they guessed wrong, did they get the money and do the improvements, but then they just weren't needed?
Yeah, I think we all expected to see a continued growth in global consumption. And it has changed, and it hasn't happened. And some of that would be the increased ability of those countries to raise their own crops and so on. That would be especially true of people like Turkey, Morocco, Algeria, and those places that used to be big, big markets for us. And some of the a few of the African countries. Africa, for the most part, is still a disaster, and they haven't got any money anyway, so they're not they couldn't pay for it. So they either get aid or nothing. But, I mean, Thunder Bay doesn't particularly care whether the grain going through is aid or what, as long as it's grain going through. But I can remember when the president of Cargill retired and went back to Europe, that one that I mentioned to you, one of his last speeches was, you know, we're going to need 20 more Lakers. And we've just sent them to the wall and to the scrapyards. Mm. There has been that change, and one has to look at that and say, what the heck happened? And I do think that... Is this still on?
Yes, but you do have the ability to restrict access
let's talk about it. There's a question here of how much grain has been shipped out of the West, because you get a system up and flowing, and you know we end up shipping grain from Manitoba to Vancouver to go to Algeria.
It may not be.
We have.
Oh.
Even shipping from the Central Prairies to Vancouver to go to Brazil. Chile is east of New York. If you look at the map, it goes like that.
And you'd like to comment on how that happens?
How much grain has been going out of Vancouver? Why would you take grain out of Vancouver? Right around, through the Panama Canal, and then right around the Horn of America to Brazil. You've gone backwards 2,000 miles to come back 2,000 miles. And yet, as you come out of here, my rule of thumb is get the grain onto the water as fast as possible. For one reason. It takes approximately 9 cents a ton mile to move grain in a truck. It takes about 3 cents a ton mile to move it in a train. And 1 cent a ton mile to move it in a ship. So the sooner you can get it onto the water, the better off you should be. So the idea of taking grain from a central point to a Montreal, Quebec, Baie-Comeau, and how you get it there is the cheapest possible. If that's all rail, let it be so. Let it be all rail. But if the ships can beat it, that's up to the shipping industry to put in place competitive rates to get it there. But from there it goes down to Brazil, which is almost a straight south movement. What do? We ship it from central points in the Perry out to Vancouver and then bring it right around the outside. Why?
Why? Why?
Yeah. Have no answer. But I think you get a momentum going of shipping with a system that gets used to that. One of the reasons is that when they change the crow rate, they re-established the rates on a mileage basis. And you might think that makes sense. Doesn't at all. You do it on a cost basis. And I can show you that it takes, and the railroads would be quick to support this argument, that when you go from Lloydminster is halfway, is 925 miles to Thunder Bay and 925 to Vancouver. So Lloydminster is the even point by miles. But the cost of pulling a train up the mountains and the cost of holding that train back to take it down the mountains is at least 15% of the total cost of running it. And if you were to move grain on the basis of the equally distant point from Montreal to the centre and from the centre to Vancouver on a cost basis, you'd go over into Alberta and you'd pull all the grain from Alberta down the St. Lawrence Seaway. They don't do that. They do it on a mileage basis with no regard for cost. So you go down to Montreal, it comes back to about Verdun or Brandon. And they come all the way over here to get the grain and ship it out to Vancouver because they're not being charged on a cost basis. So there is a why.
Hmm.
How about that?
Fascinating. I have a proposal for you once we turn off the tape.
Sure.
So thank you so much. This has been fascinating information. You've been a wonderful person to interview, and I've enjoyed meeting you.
Most welcome. Great fun.